Bloomberg Law with June Grosso. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app, iTunes, and on Bloomberg.com.
Welcome to Bloomberg Law for this Tuesday, August 2nd. I'm June Grosso. We'll analyze the business cases the Supreme Court heard last term, the lowest number of business cases in 7 years. Did business win more than it lost? The Roberts Court has often been called a pro-business court. According to a paper by law professors Lee Epstein and William Landis and Seventh Circuit Judge Richard Posner, the Roberts Court has been the most pro-business court of any since World War II. That paper considered cases from 1946 to 2011. So how did business fare in this latest term? Here to tell us is Lauren Goldman, co-head of litigation and dispute resolution at Mayer Brown. She tallies and analyzes the high court's business cases at the end of each term. And so this has turned into a yearly interview for us. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, did businesses come out ahead this term?
Marginally. It was a term of narrow cases and cases that were largely a mixed bag for business.
So what are the numbers?
The numbers were about what they normally are. It was a narrower term than usual and a smaller number of cases than usual. We look at all the cases that have a business on one side and either an individual or a government entity on the other side. And normally that number is somewhere in the low 20s. This year it was only 18 cases. Businesses won 11 of those cases, or about 60%, and that is really what we've been seeing for the last 5 or 6 terms.
So I counted among the business cases that you looked at 8 unanimous decisions, 8 decisions with 6-2 or 6-3 votes, and only one that was closely divided 4-3. Is that due to the nature of the cases or the justices' viewpoints or something else?
That's actually very typical for the business docket, June. A lot of the business cases that the court takes are not very controversial. We've seen over the last several years that many of them are decided either unanimously or it's 8-1 or 7-2. It's actually pretty unusual to have a 5-4 split in a business case.
What was the biggest win for business this year?
The biggest win by far was Spokio versus Robbins, which was actually handled by our firm and argued by my partner, Andy Pincus. And it related to the problem of no injury class actions.
Tell me more about that.
So just to take a step back, the standing requirement in federal court says that you can't bring a lawsuit unless you are actually hurt by what the defendant did. You can't just come in and say, well, this defendant did something bad, it affected lots of people, so I'm bringing a lawsuit. You have to come in and say, it harmed me. But Congress has written a lot of statutes that have very technical requirements, and a lot of those statutes have what's known as a private right of action that allows private people to sue, and they also contain provisions for statutory damages, where it's $1,000 per violation or $5,000 per violation. So what you see is people coming into court, and they say, the defendant violated the statute in some way that had some marginal impact on me, and so give me my several thousand dollars, and by the way, certify this as a class action, and give me and my lawyers thousands of dollars for all of these other people. And so this is an example of that kind of a case.
And that involved an allegedly error-ridden internet profile, that case.
Exactly. So, go on.
So some legal experts called this a narrow victory in the sense that business groups were hoping the high court, or some business groups were hoping the high court would use the case to rein in lawsuits under more than a dozen federal statutes.
Well, we really think it is ultimately going to have that effect. So the way that the lower courts had looked at this was they said, okay, if you come in and you say that the defendant violated the statute and that you were one of the people affected, then that's enough. You don't have to show that you were really harmed. So what Mr. Robbins, the plaintiff in this case, said, Spokio is a people search engine, but Mr. Robbins said it's really a credit reporting agency. And the things that Spokio said about me, well, they weren't true. So Spokio said that I make more money than I do, that I'm married when in fact I'm single, and that I'm better educated than I really am. So in saying those things, Spokio violated the Fair Credit Reporting Act, so give me statutory damages and please certify a class. So before the case got to the certification stage, our firm moved to dismiss, and we said, you don't have standing. You may have alleged that Spokio committed these technical violations, but you're not showing that you were harmed by this. And the Supreme Court agreed, and it said, even where you allege that a defendant violated a statute, you still have to allege a harm that's real, that's concrete, that is not an abstract harm. That's something really happened that affected you in a meaningful way. And this is a real victory. We're seeing a lot of the lower courts dismissing claims, especially claims under privacy statutes, saying you have to show more than a bare technical statutory violation in order to bring a claim in federal court.
I've been talking with Lauren Goldman, co-head of litigation and dispute resolution at Mayer Brown, about Supreme Court term and how business fared in that term. She tallies and analyzes the high court's business cases at the end of each term. So, Lauren, we spoke about the biggest win of the term. Now let's talk about what we might call the biggest loss of the term, Tyson Foods, where the court upheld a $5.8 million wage award to workers in a class action.
Was more of the biggest disappointment, I think, than the biggest loss. The court's ruling was really narrow, but the whole defense bar was really hoping for a big win in this case. So just to take a step back, in a class action, the class action device is not supposed to make it easier for a plaintiff to recover damages or prove his case, and it's not supposed to make it harder for a defendant to defend itself. That's written into federal law. But as a practical matter, when you smush the claims of 1,000 people together into one big lawsuit, it can make it easier for them to gloss over weaknesses in their proof, and it can make it harder for the defendant to defend itself. The issue in the Tyson case was whether a plaintiff can use statistical evidence to prove injury and damages. So the case was brought by hourly workers at a pork processing plant. And they said that Tyson hadn't paid them properly for time that they spent taking on and taking off their protective gear and walking to and from their workstations. And it was undisputed that different people in the class spent very different amounts of time doing these things and so were entitled to very different amounts of money. And it was also undisputed that a bunch of the people in the class had spent no time on these things and shouldn't recover any damages at all. And the plaintiff said, well, that's not a problem. We're just going to bring in an expert and he's going to build a model to show what the average amount of time people spent on these activities was, and that'll be enough. And the lower court said it was enough, and the court granted review. And the defense bar, the business community, was really hoping that the court would take this opportunity to clarify the rules for class actions and to make clear that you can't gloss over those kinds of individual weaknesses and issues by putting on statistical proof. But after Justice Scalia died, the court issued a very narrow opinion finding in favor of the plaintiffs.
And I should point out that plaintiffs' attorneys say that class actions are the only way for the worker or the consumer to sue in a lot of instances because they can band together and they can use that togetherness to fight a big corporation or an employer or something like that. So it's always been a class action considered good for plaintiffs' lawyers and bad for business defense lawyers. And there have been a lot of cases in the years cutting back on class actions. So do you see Justice Scalia's absence as making a difference in the business cases?
Well, it definitely made a difference here. I think if Justice Scalia had been on the court when the case was decided, the court might very well have reined in class actions. He authored several key opinions in the last few years, making it clear that while efficiency is important, you can't accomplish efficiency at the expense of the defendant's right to defend itself against the claims. So he wrote the Walmart versus Dukes opinion, and he wrote the Comcast opinion. But without him, the court issued this very narrow opinion saying that because this case was brought under something called the Fair Labor Standards Act, which has a specific provision that lets employees use statistical evidence where the employer doesn't keep good records, it was okay in this case. So it was a very narrow holding. Justice Scalia had a very specific judicial philosophy, right? I mean, we've all heard about this, that he was into strict construction of statutes, that he was against the expansion of private rights in ways that he viewed unwarranted. And that philosophy led him to write a lot of important decisions on issues that are very key to the business community. So he was, as I said, he authored several key class action decisions. He authored several important decisions holding that federal law preempted state law in key areas like product liability. He was a key part of the court that has held that arbitration clauses are fair and effective ways of resolving disputes without resort to the federal courts. So these views that formed his judicial philosophy, it sort of drove him to write a lot of opinions that were very helpful to business.
And now, looking forward, do you see the court choosing cases differently because they have eight justices?
For sure. They seem very reluctant to grant review in cases that might lead to these 4-4 splits. There were a number of 4-4 splits this past term. There were two in business cases. There was a 4-4 split on the Obama administration's immigration initiative. There was a 4-4 split on a case involving whether a state can be sued in the courts of another state. So you saw a lot of these sort of divided cases. And when the court splits like that, it doesn't issue a ruling. It just affirms automatically the decision below.
So what cases has the court said it will take in the business arena?
Not terribly many for next term. There's one class action case up for next term, a case called Microsoft versus Baker, which I hope will not be controversial. As you know, the class certification is the pivotal point in a class action because if the plaintiff wins, then he has a lot of leverage. And if the plaintiff loses then on class cert, then maybe it's not worth it to pursue the claim. And neither side gets an automatic appeal from an adverse decision on class certification. It's discretionary. Usually you have to wait to the end of the whole case before you can appeal.
Right.
But what the plaintiff did in this Microsoft case was the plaintiff lost class certification. The court said, too many individualized issues, you got to sue by yourself. And so the plaintiff voluntarily dismissed his case and then sought to appeal, saying, well, the decision on class cert was an adverse final judgment. So that's the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals actually allowed this and said you can manufacture appellate jurisdiction this way. So hopefully the court will say, no, that would be a very strange rule if a plaintiff could appeal from a bad decision on class cert, but a defendant cannot.
So you have a situation where you don't have that five-member behind Justice Scalia majority. So it could turn out to be a 4-4 and then the lower court decision. The decision of the Ninth Circuit would stand.
That is what would happen, although I think that this might be one of those cases where you end up with a lopsided majority reversing the Ninth Circuit. We see a significant number of those.
Tell us about any other business wins this term that stood out to you.
There weren't a lot of other terribly significant ones. There was a good employment decision involving a shipping company. The case relates to attorney's fees, which doesn't sound all that important, but as a practical matter, the ability to recover your attorney's fees if you win an employment case ends up deterring people from bringing frivolous claims. So this was a case where the EEOC, the federal agency in charge of employment discrimination, brought an action against a van company, and it alleged that the company committed sexual harassment of a number of people. But it never really followed up. It didn't investigate. It didn't comply with its responsibilities to conciliate the case, and the trial court dismissed it. With prejudice, you can't come back. You blew it. And so the company tried to get its attorney's fees, and the lower court said, no, you know, you have to win on the merits. You have to get a finding that you didn't discriminate. And the Supreme Court reversed, and it said, no, if a defendant can show that it doesn't have to pay money and doesn't have to change its practices, then that's a win for the defendant. And the point of this fees provision is to deter frivolous claims. A lot of frivolous claims are dismissed procedurally, and so you don't have to have a ruling on the merits to get the fees.
So now, the Supreme Court is still going to be taking more cases, so we might hear of some more business cases coming up.
Oh, for sure. There's an antitrust case for next term that the court has already granted that looks pretty interesting. It involves Visa and MasterCard. Years ago, before they went public, Visa and MasterCard were owned by associations of member banks. And the plaintiffs in this case say that the member banks conspired to keep down the prices, to push up the prices for ATM fees. And the banks are saying, well, no, we were just in a business association together. that by itself is not a conspiracy. So that should be an interesting case.
Everybody can relate to ATM fees.
Well, that's for sure.
Thank you, Lauren Goldman. She is the co-head of litigation and dispute resolution at Mayer Brown. Thanks for being on Bloomberg Law. That's it for this edition of Bloomberg Law. We'll be back tomorrow. Hope you will be as well. Thanks to our technical director, Reginald Bazile, and our producer, David Sutcherman. With All Due Respect is next for our Washington, D.C. audience, and Bloomberg Best is next for our listeners in New York, Boston, and San Francisco. I'm June Grosso. You've been listening to Bloomberg Law. This is Bloomberg.
Listen to Bloomberg Law weekdays at 4:30 p.m. Eastern in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Washington on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2 Baltimore, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, in San Francisco on 960 a.m. and 103.7 FM HD2, and Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2016 Bloomberg LP.